A reading from the book of James, chapter 1, verses 5 to 12. From James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, greetings to all God's people scattered over the whole world. My friends, consider yourselves fortunate when all kinds of trials come your way. For you know that when your faith succeeds in facing such trials, the result is the ability to endure. Make sure that your endurance carries you all the way without failing, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lack wisdom, you should pray to God, who will give it to you, because God gives generously and graciously to all. But when you pray, you must believe and not doubt at all. Whoever doubts is like a wave in the sea that is driven and blown about by the wind. If you're like that, unable to make up your mind and undecided in all you do, you must not think that you'll receive anything from the Lord. Those Christians who are poor must be glad when God lifts them up, and the rich Christians must be glad when God brings them down. For the rich will pass away like the flower of a wild plant. The sun rises with its blazing heat and burns the plant, its flower falls off, and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich will be destroyed while they go about their business. Happy are those who remain faithful under trials, because when they succeed in passing such a test, they will receive as their reward the life which God has promised to those who love Him.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to St. Luke. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried, and in Hades, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." And he said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead." This is the gospel of the Lord. Well, we're continuing our studies of the Epistle of James. So James is the brother of Jesus. He is the leader of the Jerusalem church in its very early years. And he's now writing this letter to Christians that are going through hard and difficult times. The fundamental message of what we've looked at so far over the first few weeks of our studies here is that Jesus uses trials or hard things in our life. That life in a broken world presents us along our journey of life with hard and difficult tasks. Hard situations, painful situations, even suffering and hardship. And so what James is trying to help us do is get a mental framework to understand how to react, how to handle these hard moments, because they're very confusing, aren't they? Have you ever asked yourself in the middle of something hard, why is this happening to me? Because we need a why, don't we? We need something to help us understand it and also to help us know who's going to help me with this hard thing. Central to what James is teaching is that Jesus provides us with a framework to understand it, but not just understand it, to know that he's invested in it with us, that he's actually looking to use it for our benefit and to resource us and to grow us and to develop us into full-fledged, mature, strong, stable Christians, stable people, just normal people in a hard world with some deeper stability than just what's going on around us in the world today. Who reads the news? Anybody? Who's a news reader? Okay, social media kind of forces you to some degree, if you don't, you know, kind of intentionally follow the news. Was there a lot going on in the news this week? There's a lot, if you aren't following, there's a ton of stuff. There's economic stuff, like stock market stuff, cryptocurrency stuff, American politics stuff, Canadian politics stuff. There's a lot of stuff going on. And that's like this kind of macro level. Then we look at the world. There's lots of stuff going on in the world. Can we get our stability from the stability of the macro stuff in this world? Do you find like, wow, the stock market sure makes me feel secure? Anybody? Probably not, eh? These cryptocurrencies that I purchased, you know, I feel great in them all the time. They make me feel emotionally stable. Yes? Probably not. American politics, are you like, you know what? Things that are going on there make me feel so good at home. And then we get into Canadian stuff. Like, when we look at the macro big picture, these things don't make us feel stable, do they? But then we look on the ground in our own families, our own jobs, our own finances, our own everyday stuff. Do we go, wow, all of this is so stable all the time, I feel great. Do you? No, there's just as much variables in that, isn't there? Just as much hardship. So what James is trying to help us see is that in the midst of these trials, Jesus is doing something between you and him. He is in it with you, working in you to try and develop in you a deeper stability that these other variables can't touch. Doesn't that sound nice? Doesn't it sound hopeful, at least? Right? To know that somebody's in it with you, training you, developing you, mentoring you, resourcing you. That's who Jesus is to us. And so what he does is he's training our mental framing, how we understand it. He's helping us diagnose what our faith, our trust is put into, to help us see what our hearts are depending on. And he does all of that to help us find a deeper connection with him that's more stable so we can remain steadfast in doing the good that we feel we're meant to do, to be strong in the midst of hard things so that we grow up into what James calls perfect provision in Jesus, completeness in Jesus, and lacking in nothing in Jesus. That's the definition of stability, isn't it, for us as Christians? So trials then are for us to receive deeper inner provision that develops our emotional and mental and situational stability. That's what's happening in a trial with Jesus, is he's training us into our functional adoption. Adoption meaning God the Father, the maker of the universe, in Jesus has adopted us as his children. He is our dad, and we can trust in him. He is our dad, and we're not on our own in this world. And so instead of getting our sense of self from the situation, We get our sense of self from being in Jesus and having a good father, so we have resources in a world gone mad kind of thing. Doesn't that sound good? Isn't that why you come to church? I need something deeper, bigger, stronger, better, more resourcing to me than this wild world that we live in. So that's where we get our sense of identity. That's where we get our sense of stability. And so the next thing James wants us to see then is that in the midst of trial, we're meant to learn how to ask our Father for what we need. So that we're in the midst of it going, I believe that I love you and that you love me. I believe that, like the Father saying, you're safe with me, that I'm going to look down into the mess with you and I'm going to be available to you, that I'm going to provide for you in the same way I provided for my son, Jesus. That's God's promise to his people in trial. I'll be enough for you the same way I was enough for Jesus. Don't we all want that kind of present parent in our life, no matter how old we get? Has anyone lost their parent later in life? Maybe your father or your mother passed away, or a grandparent, and you go, I know I'm an adult, I know I'm older, I know I should be self-sufficient, but there was a comfort knowing that my mom was still here, or that my dad was still here, or that my grandpa was here. We all, no matter how old we get, need this sense of overarching, my heavenly Father is caring for me, loves me, is with me, I'm not all on my own. What we see now in James's teaching is the next thing he does is steer us right into an area of life that so many of us, every human being, but also us Christians, find confusing and discouraging. What's the next thing James talks about in the epistle reading that Robin read for us this morning? Finances. How does this work when we're experiencing financial trials? The kids are learning chimes today in preparation for Christmas. I didn't just ask for like an aura to be played behind me. But it is kind of nice. It's like, we're going to talk about something hard today. So here's some chimes to kind of settle you down in the background. Like, if we're honest with ourselves, doesn't matter what generation you fall into right now, do we have a strong sense of economic stability? We really don't. There are far more questions in the world right now than there are solid answers, aren't they? Everyone I talk to seems to be going, we don't know what's going to happen. Isn't that what you hear? We don't know what's going to happen in this regard. We don't know what's going to happen next in this. We don't know what's going to happen. And so how do we be confident in the future? So whether you're young and just coming out of high school and going, I don't see how I'm going to build a life. I don't see a career that's going to get me a home, that's going to let me have a family, that's going to let me have a future. That's what I hear from teenagers, from young adults. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to get these student loans. I'm going to do this work. For what? Because there's so much uncertainty, they don't know if they can actually build a life on that. And then on the other side, our culture's going, say, to our boomer generation or to older, is that that's where the wealth is. But if you're in retirement or about to be in retirement, the instability of the global economic system makes you feel just as insecure, doesn't it? Even though I do have a house or I do have a retirement that I've saved up for all these years, that I worked for, even if I do have properties that are meant to cover us for the future, there's still so much instability out there, I don't even know if it's enough. Is that fair? So whether you are Gen Z or Gen A and just coming up into all of this instability, or in your older years, we're all still feeling that economic stress of, are we going to be okay? Is that fair? And I know that that's not an easy thing to talk about. But this is what the situation of the Jerusalem church is. In this period of time, the church is made up of three primary demographics. The seriously poor, who are actually pretty dependent on the church for food and for care. What I would title the persecuted middle class Jewish Christian. So what's happening at that time is that Rome is sick of the Jewish population, that there's conflicts going on with them, and there's been some rebellion attempts and different things like that. So what Rome does is kicks all of the Jewish community out of Jerusalem. And so this is why James is writing the letters, because all these people with homes and businesses and lives that they built up for many years have just been cast out of the city, and now we're kind of roaming the area trying to find new places to live with the little they were able to take with them. Isn't that brutal? And then we have Gentile Christians who have kind of more stability, and they're wealthier. And so this is the church, is made up of these, the seriously poor, the persecuted middle class, and the wealthier. But in this idea of money insecurity, I think it causes us to ask this question, and this is what James is getting at, is why does our financial situation impact us at such a deep level? Our financial situation isn't just practicalities, it's emotional. That the practical struggle of having enough right now is putting so much pressure on people, it makes us ask questions like, what does my financial situation say about me? When I talk to men and women who are young parents trying to build families, the questions that come out around money is, am I a failure because of how hard we're struggling? Am I a failure as a person, as a parent, as a Christian, if I have little? God says He loves me, has adopted me as His beloved child, and yet I am really struggling. I could barely make ends meet. And here's what I hear in people as they talk this through. It's shame. Because they don't see themselves as financially secure, they see themselves as failures and they're ashamed of who they are. What's the kind of consistent lines? I should have invested here. I should have saved here. I should have bought it this time. I should have sold it this time. If only I had done this in the past. Anyone said that? Just me? If I was wiser or harder working, I wouldn't be in this situation. Now, after shame, eventually shame actually becomes kind of intolerable. You're like, this is uncomfortable, and I'm sick of feeling this way about myself. And so shame switches to blame. And then we say things like, if my parents would have done ... then I wouldn't be in this situation. If my employer would just do this, I wouldn't be in this situation. If our provincial government didn't do this, then I wouldn't be in this situation. If Trudeau or Carney wasn't such a... Oh, I can't finish that. If God really loved me, I wouldn't be. This is the stuff that comes out of us when we are in financial trial. Do you agree with me? I was saying to someone recently, we were talking about preaching, and I said, you know, some of what I've come to understand as a priest is that my role is to say the things that are in your head that you don't want to say out loud. To say them from the front. That's part of my role. And then to say the things that God has said about the good news of Jesus to them. So just so you know, just because I say all this doesn't mean I believe all this. I'm just trying to name the stuff that's in our subconscious and that we all find ourselves feeling or saying when we're going through hard things. The product of this is a heart and mind and emotions filled with shame, anger, and confusion. That's the internal cocktail that's going on inside of people right now. So when you cut someone off on the highway or they cut you off, that's actually what's bubbling beneath the surface right now in our society, is this deep frustration about this friggin' life. That's what I hear from people. This is so hard, and I'm working so hard, and I can't get ahead, and I'm sick of this. And so there's an anger in our community right now in Oceanside around finances. So what comfort does James offer to those going through financial trials? That's what we're looking at now. And he begins with these words: "Let the lowly brother or sister boast in their exaltation." Let me say it again. Let the lowly brother or sister boast in their exaltation. So the poor or the lowly or the struggling should see themselves in Jesus as being exalted in the midst of their financial trial. That this trial is offering you an upgrade of heart, soul, mind into the fullness of Jesus, out of this world and into Christ. Has anyone ever been upgraded to first class on a plane that you didn't pay for? They were just like, "You come on up here." Okay, my heart is filled with envy because that has never happened to me. But that's, I can imagine, I'm going to pretend for a moment how nice that would feel for my giant legs not to be pressed up against the seat in front of me, but to be walked up and be like, "Please come sit up here in the comfy seats with better food." And then the Jerry Seinfeld, you look back at the rest of the plane, you're like, "Should have worked harder." You ever? Sorry, Jerry Seinfeld has a great bit on first class. It's pretty funny. But there's this feeling of like, come out of this and come up into comfort. Move from the C-suite to the A-suite. This actually happened for Jackie and I on our sabbatical. We went on an Alaskan cruise, and we're like, the only way we can do this is do like an inside room deep in the belly of the ship, where I imagine Leonardo DiCaprio in the Titanic is dancing with Irish music, and we'll be there. Anyway, that's what we bought. And then we got our room number and our cards, and we walked to it, and we opened the door, and Jackie literally goes, "Oh my goodness, it's not our room." Because it was a bigger room with a balcony and you could see outside. She's like, "It couldn't be ours." And I'm like, "Our names are on the key card." I'm like, "I'm pretty sure it's ours." So we don't actually know why or how that happened, but it was such a gift. It was such a big part of the experience of like, we got to watch the Alaskan coastline for a week, and we loved that. But here's what Jesus is doing, is that when you're in the midst of this, he's saying, come up here to actually something better. Where you stop getting your sense of worth or security from your financial position and instead lean into your true source. You're being offered the opportunity to develop and own your true identity in Jesus as the beloved. This confronts our shame. It confronts our desire to be self-made successes. Both those things need to bow before Jesus. Both need to be disarmed from our identity and how we measure our worth. Both need to die in light of the salvation and righteousness of Jesus. James is saying this is part of what you need to be saved from, is that you get your sense of self based on your financial performance. And for those that feel, no matter how hard I work, because I know you, I know I could list you off how hard you either have worked in the past or are working now. Your character and integrity and your follow through. And then if we were to pull up your bank account, would your bank account reflect how hard you've worked? I know most of you would feel like, no. And yet you think that that somehow is your letter grade of who you are as a person, as a man, as a mother. Jesus is saying to that very thing, we're putting that away, and I want you to see in me, you have my approval. You have my affirmation. You have my love. I look at you and am proud of you. And so James essentially wants the person who's in a lowly financial state within the church to be able to say this: I don't have anything that this world says I should have. I have to depend on others sometimes for food, for shelter, even for medical care. I'm barely surviving, but I know that the lowliness of my worldly state is an exaltation of my spiritual state. That this is the closest position to Jesus in this world. That my financial limitedness, my mental illness, my chronic pain actually keeps me close to the dirt. But it's here that Jesus is most with me and I with him. Here, I can have no ego. I can have no self-confidence. I can have no strength. But I do have Jesus. And in Jesus, I am seated at God's right hand. That's what James is saying. That the person who's going through severe hardship or loneliness in this life should see that Jesus is closer to them in that struggle than ever. And that in that closeness to Jesus, you're being exalted up into the love and favor and blessing and goodness of God. That he gives you not just dignity, but exaltation. That's the Christian belief about those who are struggling in this world. Do you hear me? Do you agree to that? Do you believe that? This is how the early church leadership thought and taught. This is real Christianity. And so there are many of you here today that have allowed your financial position in this world to determine your sense of self. That needs to stop here with Jesus. You believe the lie that you have no worth because you have no wealth. Often when I'm reading the news, when I'm hearing about what's going on in the world, it kind of sounds like the ultra-wealthy out there, it's like being filled with a world run by dragons. I'm a J.R.R. Tolkien fan. I love Lord of the Rings. So this is kind of how, it's the picture I see of it. It's like these big dragons hoarding gold. And the rest of the world is like, How do we survive in this when all the dragons are holding the gold and they're all over the world? But instead of trying to figure out how to slay these dragons or how to, you know, sneak a piece of gold without getting caught, Jesus is saying it doesn't matter because I'm with you in the dirt. I'm with you in the hardship. And what those dragons think about you does not reflect your true self. What I think about you does. And it makes us ask the question, how does this change the way we see the poor amongst us in our region? Those living in tent cities, those waiting outside of Walmart or McDonald's. Do we see them as with Jesus? Like, part of the way the early church talks about this is that you should pursue relationship with the poor not to be a philanthropist, not to actually be a blessing to them, but because if you're near to the poor, you're near to Jesus. That the closer you get to them in relationship, you will find Jesus the way you need to find him. Isn't that an upside down way of thinking about it? Compared to the way we're taught it? So then here's what James goes on to say. And the rich should boast in their humiliation because like a flower of the grass they will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass. Its flower falls and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich person fade away in the midst of their pursuits. So James is saying, just as the poor should see themselves as exalted in their already lowly estate, so should the rich in the community rejoice when they suddenly experience great losses of wealth, property, investments, titles, or influence. James is saying that experience of humiliation one would feel after losing it all, so to speak, is a gift. How would he say that? Why would he say that? Because James is saying they were going to be separated from their wealth no matter what. That this is what death does. It reveals that none of this holds any real security or value. None of this makes you good. None of this defines your success. None of this pays for your sins. None of this buys your way into Christ's kingdom. None of it is even yours. Ownership is an illusion. The inevitability of this world is that the sun will rise and scorch your crops and wither your grass. The flower of your life will fall, and your youth and your beauty and strength will perish. All of it will fade away in the midst of your pursuits. That's James's teaching. So losing it sooner rather than later, so that you can see how you've misplaced your trust in it, how misguided your pursuits have been, is actually a loving humiliation, James is saying. A lowliness that will enable you to see Jesus more clearly and your need more deeply, so that your soul will be more truly satisfied. James is essentially saying, when we see the stock prices go down, instead of going, ugh, we should go, thank you for this opportunity to actually push into my true identity with you. That you are my source of stability. You are the one that I live for. You are the one that I love, not these numbers, not this increase. The black or red, whatever the numbers do, I don't care because I have you. I read this comment recently in a theologian's chat where this one theologian kind of summarized Jesus' teaching on this. And he said this, or she said this, when Jesus says, woe to the rich, because this is one of Jesus' big phrases, woe to the rich, grief for the rich. He tells them they are receiving their comfort already. That is, they are comforting themselves through their own wealth. The Greek word for comfort is paraklesis, which is very close to the word for the comforter, which is a word we use to describe the Holy Spirit, parakletos. Jesus seems to be saying the rich would rather comfort themselves than be comforted by God's Spirit. Or perhaps because the rich have comforted themselves, they see no need to accept God's Spirit. And in rejecting the Comforter, they are rejecting the Spirit of adoption that would allow them to be called children of God. When Jesus says we cannot serve God and money, it's not just about divided loyalties. He is warning our very souls hang in the balance. Wealth pulls us away from God into a world where we have the power, the control, the ability to fulfill our every desire. Yet Jesus offers himself, his power over death, if we would surrender control and let him be the desire of our heart. I heard one pastor explain that our Western secular society is more easily traumatized by hardship than almost every other culture in the world. Because we have in our mind the expectation that if I work hard, if I get enough money, I should be comfortable and not experience hardship. And so we're surprised by the brokenness of this world. This is what James is saying is to get to accept it, to go, look, at the end of this life, I lose it all anyway. And I only have what I have in Jesus. So I might as well lose it now to ensure that my heart is truly invested in Jesus. Imagine the rich person amongst us being able to say, this financial trial I am in is so humbling that it is deconstructing my self-worth in my financial success. It's tearing down the ego I built through my achievements and has made me have to face my false identity in such a way that I'm forced to really believe and trust in who Jesus says I am in Him. So much so that I can finally say that I'm thankful, I'm joyful for how I've lost everything and everyone I once placed my trust in. What I once would have called failure, I now call a gift because it helped me see how much I trusted in my financial success for my sense of self and my sense of comfort. I want to tell everyone about how blessed I am to finally see how having much was actually having little. And now that I have little, I finally have much, for I am closer to Jesus in my poverty than I ever was in my plenty. Imagine the rich amongst us being able to talk like that. Our bodies pastor us for our death by helping us see, even if your investments are going up, even if your property values are going up, your body isn't going up in strength forever, is it? Is that okay to say? Right? You eventually start hitting this point where it's like, no matter what I do, what I eat, what supplements I have, what training I do, my body is getting weaker, is getting sick at times, is harder to keep going. I nap more. You know, those types of things. Our bodies help us get ready because the illusion of our finances are, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. But our bodies are going, no. Speaking to the soul saying, death is coming. Death is coming. We are only good if we have Jesus. You see that? So James then goes on to say, blessed is the person who remains steadfast under trial, steadfast holding to their love for Jesus and Jesus' love for them. For when they have stood the test, they will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love them. So blessed is the person who holds on to the very end, who only finds their sense of self and comfort in Jesus by choice. No matter how much pressure the world puts on them, by choice they choose Jesus. And when you have stood the test, because this life is a test, to really see, do you really love and trust Him? That in the end, for those who withstand the test, on the other side of this pain, something waits for you. Isn't that good news? At the end of this hardship, at the end of this life of suffering, at the end of all this pain, something waits for you. And it's not just the abyss. It's not just the darkness. Love is waiting for you at the finish line here. And love waits for you with a crown of life. And the New Testament language of this crown of life is like finally freedom from all this death, freedom from all this suffering, freedom from all this hardship, pure, unadulterated life. The, the life that we've actually been longing for all this time. But we have to get through this to get to that. But if you take away that promise of the good end, what is the purpose of all of this? Even if you're a hedonist that goes, the purpose of all this is you only live once, so you have as much pleasure as possible. You will reach the end of pleasure before you die. This isn't enough. And so the promise in Jesus is that this is just the beginning, not the end. At the end of all of this is God's crown of life to go, come into all of this goodness with me. And it's given, James says, to those who love God. That all of this trial is about learning to find love in Him to withstand what's hard in this world. He loves you. He loves you individually, specifically, uniquely in your situation. And He wants you to learn to receive that love in the situation instead of trying to find a situation that makes you feel loved. That's real strength. That's real identity that goes, I don't need this to go good to feel good. I know I'm good in Jesus. Don't you want that kind of stability? That's dignity. That's human dignity. That's human strength. Because it's all in relationship to the divine. Yes, trials test whether we really trust Him. But in the trial, we find Him and we find true love. And at the end of all of this is His celebration of His beloved. Where He says to you, well done, good and faithful servant. Welcome home. So for those of you who are nearing the end of your life, hear me. This is a momentary suffering because on the other side of this is pure, unadulterated love and goodness in Him. Don't fear your death. Don't fear it. Because on the other side of it is His love for you. And for those of you that look at a full life ahead of you, just in university or whatever, this is freedom to know that you're not working for your own provision and satisfaction. You have that in Jesus. The occupation you will do in this world is to better the world, to do good for this world, knowing you're provided for.